Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Our guest today is currently a program administrator for Priority Dispatch Corp. He's worked in fire, EMS, and police emergency communications since 2001, including roles in quality, training, and supervision. Most recently, he was the coordinator of the Northwell Health Center for Emergency Medical Services Quality Improvement Unit in Syosset, New York. He was instrumental in the center's recognition as New York's first medical accredited center of excellence and the world's second emergency communication nurse system ACE. He's also a longtime believer in the value of research and data analysis for system improvement. Welcome, Tony Guido.
Good day, everybody.
Before we get started, could you give our listeners some background about yourself? How did you get involved in emergency communications and what brought you into this industry?
Absolutely. My father was a firefighter, and the thing to do when you're growing up was join the junior fire department over in Northport, New York, where I grew up. And I started out there under the direction of some really talented people that were trying to grow the profession of firefighting. And from there, once I turned 18, I was able to join as a full-fledged firefighter. So once I joined as a firefighter, I noticed that there was a dispatch spot open in our local fire department. And so I went through training to become an emergency medical dispatcher for the firehouse, which handled medical and fire calls. It was a single seat center. It was quite small. Back then we had, you know, these old Z-tron boards with you would push little buttons and the sirens would go off, and I'd actually go to high school, and then I would go and work a 4 to 12 shift where you could actually get your homework done, which was good. And so I was one of few people that had jobs in that realm. When you grow up on Long Island, you get very ambitious sometimes because you see that a lot of people around you are working many, many jobs. And I just loved it so much that I ended up working for two fire departments, then eventually becoming a police dispatcher as well. So I was working multiple places quite often.
And what made you choose emergency communications? Just because you saw the spot open, or?
Yeah, and I was intrigued by dispatch and what they did, and it's very process. I'm a kind of a process-oriented person, and I like the idea that, you know, the calls came in and they would assess the patient, and then they would triage it and then give out information to the responding units, and you always kind of knew what was going on. You know, when people would say that they did know what was going on, I'd say, no, I really knew what was going on, you know, and it was kind of very exciting, I think.
So quality improvement is clearly kind of your bread and butter. You worked in the quality improvement unit at Northwell, and your role at Priority Dispatch now involves more of a regional look at some of these different centers, helping other agencies measure and improve their performance in particular. So what makes you so committed to quality improvement?
When you see a problem in depth and you don't just look at it from the surface, and then you see what you can do to change performance, behaviors, operations, and then you see the positive effect it has on your response, on just people seeing this little glimmer in the eye. I think Dr. Clausen says it best when he talks about the it factor, when someone really gets it. And I think from a quality improvement standpoint, you can kind of get it and see this glimmer of hope in something that could seemingly be a very big task, like changing the emergency response system or changing a call taker's performance or even their engagement into what their job is.
So you said you're kind of a process guy. When you go into one of these agencies and you're trying to help them make change, you're trying to help them make improvements, what's your process? Where do you start?
I think you start by talking to people and learning about the person themselves. You know, when we think about diving into how a system is functioning, how their training is working, how their quality improvement, how their supervisors function, that's really the second step. I think the first step is getting to know the people and what really drives them. Once you learn a little bit about a person, you can kind of start to figure out how they got to where they are. And then it's like a Titanic, you know, you want to move it. You can't obviously take the ship and turn the wheel as fast as you can. Otherwise, you might hit iceberg either way. But you can kind of look at it and say, okay, what can we do to kind of direct your energy to something that you understand and want to work with?
Can you give us an example of that? Somebody that you've worked with where maybe they weren't moving in the right direction, or you found that they needed some help getting their energy going in the right direction. What is it that you look for, and how do you help them understand the value of the it factor?
I think it really, you focus a lot of your energy, and the discussion that the squeaky wheel gets the grease is kind of sometimes true. But if you go into, and let's say I'm teaching a class, like I'm, you know, big fan of doing Q instruction, and I still very much involved in getting out there and teaching Q. And one of the things that I'll notice is if I have somebody who's, they kind of look befuddled, or they're not sure if they're grasping the concept, or, you know, even during introductions when I ask them, you know, what their experience is in emergency dispatch. And if I see like this lack of interest, what I would usually like to do is focus on that person and see if I can find something that they really enjoy. So if I'm, for instance, I'm teaching a Q class and someone's like, yeah, I'm just a dispatcher. That to me is a really key for me to focus on and really express to them how much I believe their job's important, having sat in that seat. But more importantly, how can I get them to see what we're doing? So I'll sometimes not necessarily pick on them, but I'll ask them to provide some examples. I'll engage them into the day-to-day operations, because even the people that think that they're not sure if they know things, they really do. You could be a dispatcher for 2 weeks and you'd be able to teach somebody something new just because you have a different eye on things.
So what do you think is the cure for the just a dispatcher mentality? We hear sometimes that same phrase coming from people that, well, I'm just a dispatcher. We get it from when we try to get people involved in research or whatever. What's your approach to that?
I think you have to continue to connect these positive experiences back to dispatch. You know, when I worked as an EMT in New York City, when you were able to see a patient who would get relief from giving them an epi injection because they were having an allergic reaction, or you're able to give them some oxygen and just even provide that emotional support that sometimes would calm them. That's tangible. You can see that. In dispatch, we really have to be empathetic, right? When we're listening to callers, one of the things that we do is try to put ourselves in their shoes. And we do it up to the point of when we hang up the phone. And I think we forget to really see that there's something else that happens in the days, weeks, and months following that moment. And that is the relief in the family. You know, if we've done everything to help a loved one, if we've gotten someone back, which is just so exciting. You know, I had the opportunity of connecting a dispatcher one time to physically be there on scene while they got to meet the person that they saved. Mm. It's extremely powerful. And it's not just, you know, the lives that we save. There's a lot of positive impact. So if somebody is just a dispatcher, I would venture to say that my experience has shown they haven't had that personal connection sometimes that really will give them a little more value to see what they can do from behind that seat.
Hmm. That's very interesting. One of the things that we talk about a lot is getting feedback for dispatchers. So a lot of times, maybe they feel that they're not included in the debriefings, or maybe they don't really get to connect with the responders who do get to be on the scene, or maybe they don't know what happened to the patient. Is that something that you've worked with agencies to help the dispatchers get more of that feedback from their calls?
Yeah, it's a thing that we really push. And you know what? My first Q instructor, Kim Rigdon, is a big fan of talking about catching them doing it right. Mm-hmm. You know, and that mantra that we believe in that really does work. And I got to say that, you know, 10 years ago when I started into the Q land, I wasn't actually a firm believer in that. I didn't quite grasp it until I started doing it. And then I could see that when you did provide positive feedback and you did encourage someone, the benefits were really, really palpable.
Hmm. And how about getting that feedback you're talking about, like when you get to meet the person you saved or something like that? What are some ways that we can help dispatchers get more of that direct feedback on not just saves, but all the calls that they work with?
One of the things I'm working now with implementations is when we build, there's two things that we've always talked about, which is obviously our dispatch review committee, which is a vital function of definitely a high-performing emergency service system. And in our dispatch review committees, I'll talk about creating agendas that include exemplary performance.
Hmm.
So now if you think about it, on a dispatch review committee, I'd want representation from the fire department, the police department, and the EMS system. Those are three key facets of what we do, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And if I look at it and say, okay, the paramedic arrives at the meeting, and he's talking about a call that he recently took where he got on scene, and he saw the family member doing CPR, and he had what we would call a workable arrest.
Right.
And so now we're like, okay, we got to go. And he gives his medications, and he starts, you know, continues CPR, and he gets the patient back. He or she, that paramedic or EMT, says, okay, I know that somebody was doing something beforehand. And when that gets communicated to the dispatch review committee, we can start to connect the dots between what the dispatcher did, and maybe that the field doesn't quite understand what they fully do. And then as vice versa, maybe the dispatcher doesn't fully understand what's going on in the field. So we need to continue to do that. That's definitely one facet, is exemplary performance. I actually was recently at an implementation, and the doctor came in, the medical director, and he said, hey, I really wanted to tell you that he's talking to the paramedic supervisor, and he says, last week, they had a really complicated airway that came into the ER, and the paramedic did a really fantastic job. And duly noted, the dispatcher, in hearing the tape, had actually done a really good job of maintaining what was a very difficult unconscious patient. So just hearing that discussion at dispatch review committee, they were having an informal discussion before him, but then I decided to make it more part of the formal discussion, because we need to be talking about those things. The second facet that is really valuable is we've always talked about field feedback forms. Hey, what happens if you arrive on scene and you find something different than was dispatched to you? From a quality assurance and quality improvement perspective, I want to know about those things. Mm-hmm. I can't see 100% of my calls. So those are moments that we obviously are, you know, low frequency, but high risk to our service system. So what I like to do is say, okay, this is something that we need to also look at from a positive feedback. So maybe I should give a field feedback form when I see something in the field that I know a dispatcher did really well. I was on my way to the scene for what was seemingly a traditional fall call, but it turned out to be an assault. And rapidly, I was able to pull my unit over and stage until police could make contact. And that has a very big value to our responders. So connecting those dots in a field feedback form, and if anybody out there is listening, I would say, I urge you to really promote field feedback to be both those things that you see that may change and you don't understand why it happened when you got on scene, but as well as those positive interactions, you can connect the dots with your communication professionals.
And what about going back the other direction? So one of the things that we run into is that, and this is something you just mentioned, that responders may not actually know what dispatch does. How do we bridge that gap better? How do we help? What tools can we give to the dispatch centers to help them teach responders what they do or to work with them better?
I see a lot of value in your field orientation, including a communications debriefing or a communications module in the training. And not just someone that comes in for 10 minutes and says, oh, this is a communication center. We have phones. When you pick them up, somebody answers them and gets information, and that eventually translates to you. I think what we need to look at that is say, okay, well, I have something going on in the communication center, and what is that thing? And explaining the entire process to the paramedics. And then, of course, huge fan of getting what we call sit-along time, right, in the communication center. More recently, I was at an agency that said they do sit-along time, but they're not so sure that the paramedics and EMTs gain the value that they want out of it. So I said, well, what do you want them to gain out of it? And they went through a list of things that they wanted, the, you know, better interactions between their communication professionals and their emergency responder professionals. And what we decided to do was come up with an expectations list. So now when they come into the communication center, and the EMTs, paramedics, firefighters, police officers, all of our fantastic responders out there have expectations of what they're supposed to do during that shift. They're not just there to sit there and chat it up, which, by the way, is a good thing for,
right,
you know,
because
just,
then they get to know each other,
which is always awesome. Yeah. But on top of that, say, okay, well, how do you take the call? You know, how does the call come in? What are you looking for? Right. What are things that you worry about? You know, and we kind of went through and developed some expectations that the paramedics and EMTs in this one agency were going to be required to fill out. And I think that that's really showing the value. And on top of that, what we decided to do is once they were done with that sit along time, they were to meet with the training coordinator and discuss what they saw in dispatch. Hey, what did you see? What are some things that you really liked? What are some things that, you know, you see as a benefit? And I think that's definitely a really good direction that we need to be going. So for those of you out there that are doing sit along times, think about creating expectation lists. And if you're not doing it, just, you know, try to go out there and get some time for them. And I believe that that's equally important when you can, in your agency, send dispatchers out on the road so they can see what's going on.
Right. So on a little bit different note, when you were at Northwell, you were pretty clearly committed to the ACE project, to becoming an accredited center of excellence, not just in medical, but in ECNS also, which you were the world's second ECNS ACE, which, congratulations.
Thank you.
So what made you so committed to the ACE project? What does ACE do for a center, and why should they care about that?
You know, when I look at ACE, you know, luckily to have someone like Kim Rigdon as one of your mentors really lights a fire under you to really understand how great you can make a communication center. So when I really looked into ACE and started learning and talking to other people that were ACE, there's this glow and this shimmer in someone's eye when they can say that they went through those 20 points and they knocked them out of the park. And the benefits I saw were really tangible to the dispatcher themselves. Mm. I often say when I'm teaching classes, and as some of my students have heard me say, is the success of a dispatcher is often defined as not making a bad situation worse.
Right.
So think about going home at the end of the day, and you know, I'll go home. My wife will say, "Oh, how was your day, honey? It was good. Some people died, but I didn't kill any more."
Right.
And that's tough, right? So when we look at ACE, we look at it as something that is successful, you know, as a person and as an agency. There's no other way, I think, or no better way, rather, to connect the dots of high-performing individuals to the goal of a system.
Hmm.
And when I look at dispatchers who can say, I'm one of the top 5% of call-taking centers in the world, there is something to be said for that. I saw as tremendous value in just this shift from surviving your shift, mm-hmm. right, to just going in there and having a goal of making sure you were highly compliant, not because you were concerned about getting in trouble, but because you knew that as a person, you had value to the team's goal of maintaining those percentages and going for reaccreditation. One of my mentors and my old boss there over at Northwell Health, John Washko, who's on a member of the College of Fellows, John had said, you know, getting accredited is a challenge, but keeping it is twice as much.
That's interesting.
And he said it requires this constant evaluation of how you're doing and not assuming that what worked today will be fixing the problem tomorrow. And I think it keeps you on your toes, which as a dispatcher, we're really good at.
Right.
But from a quality improvement perspective, it really brings us value to know that we can continue to keep that ship sailing really smoothly along those rough waters.
So it sounds like it's a cultural shift as much as anything else.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to ACE, I think there's not just it's not just filling out points and uploading them to the website, which is such a great breeze. I started out my first ACE application I did in the old binder format with papers, and it teaches you a lot. But the new system is so friendly and so nice, you know, and you realize that when you go through each one of those points, you have to not only just fill in paperwork, but you have to get the buy-in of the people around you. You have to have every dispatcher in that center understand what it means to be an accredited dispatcher, so they can join that challenge and succeed together. And I don't care if it's the person that's there for 2 weeks or 20 years. If you just came in the door, good, you're on our team. Let's go do this together, because you have just as much vested into this as all of us do.
Hmm. And in addition to the cultural changes or the changes in individuals, did you see like measurable outcomes from being ACE? Did you have particular outcomes that you were tracking or anything you were looking at from your ACE to see if it was being successful?
Well, I think the reduction of field feedback forms of, you know, North Shore LIJ, or at the time that was, you know, before they came Northwell Health, you know, employed almost 800 EMTs and paramedics. And we had given out, you know, about 40,000 emergency calls a year for a secondary PSAP in a hospital-based EMS system. And those paramedics who are, you know, very well trained and very committed to patient care, were quite quick to voice their concerns if something didn't add up. And as we became accredited and continued to excel in our performance, we saw tangible benefits in a reduction of paramedic concerns and EMT concerns. One of the things we saw is that when you can accomplish ACE and get to that point, that's one facet of a communication center. There's a lot of other things going on.
Right.
But all of a sudden, dispatchers see a new challenge or something as a change, and as you mentioned, the culture, and they say, I can handle that. We got ACE. We can handle that. And, mm-hmm. and they kind of see it as a litmus test to know whether or not they can take on new and exciting ventures.
Huh, that's interesting. So we could do this. We did this. So whatever the next challenge is, we'll get that too.
Yeah.
Huh. I'd like to just ask you one more thing before you go, which is, as someone who's interested in quality improvement, where do you see the biggest barriers to change or change adoption in the emergency communications field, and how do we get past those?
I think we need to continue to commit resources to quality assurance, quality improvement, and training.
Hmm.
I know that certainly around not only just the country itself and the U.S. and Canada, but in all the countries that we work tirelessly in, that there are staffing issues. We understand that. And it's something that I know that every center is working hard to accomplish. is just improving, you know, minimum staffing guidelines. Mm-hmm. And in the face of that, it's quick to reassign your trainer or your quality assurance specialist or your quality improvement coordinator to the seat. Right. And while it's important, I believe that everybody who's in QA, QI, and training needs to rotate and sit in that seat so they know what's going on. They need to be afforded time to be able to complete their tasks and continue to push forward with creating CDEs and getting those out. That's a consistency challenge. So I think for the directors out there and the big decision makers, continue to focus on trying to fight for everything you can to keep your quality assurance programs growing. There are tangible benefits. And we talk about liability in Q class, but I always say liability is not liability. Liability is a person. Hmm. You know, I always think of it, we tend to work where we live and, you know, and care for those people that we do. So if my family member calls, I want them to reach the highest trained medical, fire, or police dispatch professional out there. And I want to know that they're going to do everything they can. And having been on that side, you know, having called 911 for my loved ones, reaching somebody who is in a center that's doing quality assurance and doing a great job is amazing. You know, it really is.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. You guys have a good day.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardette. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.